talks like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is John Doe, the singer, songwriter, and co-founder of legendary punk band X. In addition to wearing still other hats, including actor and horse advocate, Doe is also the author of More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of L.A. Punk. Like his 2016 predecessor, the new book is co-authored by Tom DeSavia and features essays and other pieces by musicians and others weighing in on the late 70s, especially early 80s, L.A. punk scene and its legacy. This means contributors like Henry Rollins, Social Distortion's Mike Ness, the Go-Go's Jane Wheedlin and Charlotte Caffey, Dave Albin, Louis Perez of Los Lobos, Excellent Justice frontwoman Maria McKee, and many, many others. Doe presides over this literary salon with periodic pieces of his own and interviews, including a fascinating, revelatory, and ultra-timely conversation with some members of Fishbone. This is an extraordinary book, and part of its excellence is that even if you don't care much about that punk scene or even know much about it, many of these stories and observations end up being profoundly universal in addressing major themes ranging from coming of age, the costs and rewards of pursuing what you're passionate about, regardless of the obstacles, to redemption tales of various stripes. We'll discuss the book, X, Austin, horses, maybe other topics when I speak with John Doe in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later on in the program, I'll speak with Allison McCulloch, a film critic who laces her reviews for the site Letterboxd with vegan alerts, cautionary tidbits she thinks vegans might appreciate knowing before seeing that movie. Right now, though, let's get to John with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is John Doe on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, John Doe.
Hello, Duncan.
It's pretty early, especially in Austin, so thank you very much for doing this live so some folks maybe could call in and speak with you or send a text that I can pass along or whatever. But it seems like you've already had a very busy morning, including getting the horse's new shoes.
Just trimmed. They're, I'm trying to get this old guy to go barefoot. He's being very stoic. I have a quarter horse gelding who's 28.
Oh my goodness.
And he's had shoes his whole life, and in the mud he lost both of his front shoes, and when I came back one week and it was like he seemed to be fine, so I'm trying him out on barefoot.
Okay.
I think it's physical and psychological.
Yeah, no, so sure enough, because at first I didn't see these pictures that you had sent through, but what is this horse's name? We should be calling by his proper
red.
Name.
Red? Red, because he's red. He's
okay.
Not colored.
All right. Even I can follow that thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the fact that I am at the barn and using my freaking cell phone to do this interview while I'm just, I've actually got my arm over the other pony, Sugar.
Yeah, well, yeah, first of all, this is an animal show, ostensibly, so I think it's great that we're going to start off talking maybe a little bit about horses, and that you're actually there with Red and in the barn on the cell phone. This couldn't be more perfect for talking animals.
I know.
So I'm only wondering if maybe the next book, if there is going to be one, if the farrier could perhaps contribute an essay.
Maybe so.
Okay, we'll think
maybe
about it.
Well,
so anyways, last time you were, actually maybe the last couple times you were on the show, we did discuss a few horse topics, including your feelings about the Bureau of Land Management's Wild Horse and Burro Roundup program. Any different or new current thoughts on that Roundup program?
Well, I not really, except that it seems that there's some private sector people that are stepping in and buying huge plots of acreage and you know, just turning horses out there and letting them fend for themselves, which is what I support. I mean, for better or for worse, you know, as long as they have adequate forage and water. And it seems as though there's a CANA Foundation, C-A-N-A Foundation, that seems to be doing good stuff. There's another one, a couple in like Idaho and Montana, and it's like, just stop it, you know. It's I don't know. But, yeah, I just give some money and, you know, lend support when I can. If there's, I wish that people would do more benefits that I could go, you know, play or something. But,
yeah,
I just try to take care of my guys and stand up when I can. And, yeah, it's, I really support all the people that adopt them and train them and all that kind of stuff. Cause that's a way to keep them out of the, you know, those feedlots and stuff. You know,
right.
You can go adopt them from the feedlots, train them up, and then you know, sell them to people who want to have a piece of the American West, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, so. Disrupting the horrible path that many of these horses are otherwise on.
So
the last time we spoke, at least on air, was before you moved to Austin. Since becoming an Austin resident, have you become involved with any horse welfare or advocacy organizations there?
No, just feeding my guys.
Yeah, just looking after Red. Yeah.
Red and Sugar are well taken care of. I got a good barn and a lot of trails. And,
nice.
You know, I haven't really connected with any horse community except the ones that are here at this barn.
But I do recall you were a real supporter of that horse advocacy organization, Protect Mustangs. So
yep.
I'm sure they're still your go-to group.
I just have a monthly donation and hope that they can, you know, find legal opportunities, because that's really where it comes down to, you know, fostering and you know, having sanctuaries is all well and good, but really it's just the laws that need to be changed and
right,
you know, try to get the BLM to you know, leave them alone and not be so in the pocket of the ranchers. But I don't know. I mean, the BLM just moved to Grand Junction, Colorado, so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah,
whether they're more in the pocket or less, or like more influenced or less influenced by the people that are close by.
Yeah, well, at the risk of sounding too cynical, I would say probably more influenced and more in the pocket, but we shall see. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tune in, my guest is John Doe, the singer-songwriter, co-founder of the great band X. He's also an actor, horse advocate, as we're just talking about, and author, most recently, of More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of L.A. Punk, which is overseen by Joe and his kind of co-author of sorts, Tom DeSavvy, and then featuring contributions by a huge array of denizens of the late 70s, early 80s L.A. punk scene. So if you'd like to ask John a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So indeed, let's talk about the book. So as I mentioned near the top of the show, I found the new book, More Fun in the New World, to be extraordinary in a way that I think doesn't necessarily require a reader to be conversant with the LA punk scene. It's obviously the focus in a sense, but I just feel that it sort of cumulatively offers some sort of universal truths and themes that end up transcending the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
How does that hit you?
Well, it got broader. I explained the concept of the second book, which I did just because we had the opportunity, and the publisher said, "Hey, the first one did pretty good, so
yeah,
you know, we have an option, and we're going to take that option." It's like, okay,
yeah.
I guess that settles that. I guess we're doing a second book.
Sure.
And then I was explaining it to my partner, and she said, "I said, well, it's going to be about, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll and people getting lied to by record companies and going on tour and the hardcore scene kind of taking over and." You know, our original community kind of falling apart and people dying and like, oh, it's going to be crazy. And she goes, that sounds horrible. don't do that.
What else you got?
It's really negative and horrible.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what do you think, Smarty Pants? What should it be? And she thought for a minute and said, well, what about the legacy of the people that were influenced by it? And that's when we added that element and I, you know, looked up some of the friends that I've got, and you know, Tim Robbins was influenced by it, the actor, and so was Allison Anders, the film director, and
yeah,
Tony Hawk, the skateboarder, and Shepard Fairey, the artist.
Yeah.
And so it just got a whole broader element to it.
And so
those people just took that philosophy and that ethos and that DIY sensibility and applied it to what they did.
Right. You know? I mean, part of what I think accounts for the scope and the depth that I was referring to is that, Robbins and Anders and Farian do contribute. So you have the key kind of direct figures of the scene, but you have people that in their own work were closely paying attention or at those shows or just generally influenced by the kind of ethos.
Yeah.
And then
also it's about the way that the scene got bigger and splintered into several different genres, and the way those genres have influenced the current musical trends.
Yeah.
You may not know who the Circle Jerks or Flipper are, but you probably know who Green Day is.
And, right.
And you don't know, you probably don't know who Maria McKee is, but you may know who Nico Case is. And
for sure.
You don't know rank and file, but you probably know some of the country acts that sound like them nowadays, or Wilco, the whole alt country thing. So
yeah,
it kind of shines a spotlight on people that may have may not be in like household names, but they still have this great value and stuff.
Yeah, I think they're clearly antecedents for some of those artists you've mentioned. And I do think, again, some of their stories, like I say, I think just end up, whether they set out to do it or not, just hit really broad, in some cases, universal themes. And we'll come back to that in a sec, but we've got at least one of our callers that's already been holding for a while. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with John Doe. Hello, it's you. Oh, they got shy or bailed at the last sec. Okay. So one of the things that, because even what you presented to your partner about what the book might be, and she said, well, that sounds horrible, let's do something else and get into the legacy. I mean, there is it's not totally lacking in sort of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
But there's plenty of that.
Yeah, but even those pieces tend to be marked, in most cases at least, by an eloquence, and sometimes they're just a total blast to read. Like, I guess one in each category. Maybe you can talk for a moment about the piece by Charlotte Caffey of the Go-Go's entitled, not coincidentally, Deliverance. What was your first reaction when she turned that piece in?
Blown away.
Yeah.
Completely blown away, because I knew Charlotte then, before the Go-Go's were America's sweetheart, and was kind of bemused by the fact that the mass media had turned these scrappy punk rock chicks into well-scrubbed pop icons.
Yeah.
But I had no idea that Charlotte struggled with heroin addiction, and her chapter was about that and getting into recovery and still maintaining her creativity.
Yeah.
Which, a lot of people, once they get on something, they'll have a big flash of creativity, and then whatever drug or alcohol takes over, and then it just kind of peters out.
Yeah.
Like Jack Kerouac or anyone, that gets addicted. And so really a terrific story about recovery. And she's been sober for 30 some years now, a long time.
Yeah.
Everyone was willing and able to get to it, do the job, and found their own voices. We kind of encouraged them to do that, not to try to overreach and be fancy and be I'm a writer now, I've got to write like a writer. They just wrote like themselves.
Yeah.
And that kind of adds some, people can relate to it, relatability.
Yeah, no, they're highly personal, and in the best kind of highly personal writing, it's again very universal in many cases, at least. And so on kind of a different front, about the contribution by Pleasant Gaiman, who, again, most people, unless you were in or around the scene or on the periphery, I mean, I was in Orange County at the time, so I was close enough, and so, but she's like worn multiple hats for many years on the LA scene, journalist, musician, club book, or several more, but her piece is just teeming with energy and colorful revelations and no-hold-barred observations about herself and others. So any particular reaction to that, or just like, oh my God, this is kind of what we thought we'd get from Pleasant?
It's exactly what we hoped.
Yeah.
And it was, even better, because it starts with her, blazing on several tabs of acid and imagining that she's Marilyn Monroe. And
yeah.
We've done a couple of book events, and Pleasant has been at
I hit the button quick enough, so no problem.
Talk stuff.
Yeah, okay, I think I got it in time, yeah.
You know, about the old days, but
yeah.
It's like a roller coaster. Reading Pleasant is just like, it's going real fast. You don't know exactly where it's going to go, but it's going to be fun.
Right, well, that's just, so I can only imagine these things she's doing on stage now, because she's a classic.
You know, there's a filter, but the only filter is really not to be mean to anybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
She'll talk just all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah. Well, no, she's the sort of ultimate colorful raconteur, and her writing has long been in the same mode. So whether you're reading her or listening to her, there's nobody quite like her. So, yeah, that's definitely a striking part of that of this book. So let's try another phone call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with John Doe.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Do you have a question or comment for John?
Oh, yeah. I saw him at Lincoln Theater in Washington, D.C. playing Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. I think X was one of the greatest bands that ever came out. And horses, yeah. I got a friend who has small place and keeps horses, too. Older abandoned horses.
So, there you go.
And I want to thank you for your music yesterday. That was a nice little run. It made me feel good.
You're welcome. We're starting up again in a couple of days. We're playing out in California.
Oh, cool. And I'm wondering, do you know The Kill?
I know of them. I don't know them personally.
Oh,
they're
no, because they're to me, because I was there way back when in D.C., and I saw them, and I'm like, wow, this is a continuation of the whole punk scene from way back when. So I would say check out The Kill. They got a different thing going on. You know, the strong.
Oh, no, I know who they are. I listened to them.
Oh, you just never met them. Okay,
yeah.
Cool, dude.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for your call.
I want to say thanks a lot for having them on, man.
For sure.
And to hear you again. Must not think bad thoughts.
Okay, appreciate your call. Thank you. So, John, at least one or two more quick things about the book. I mean, one thing, I just don't think we can talk about the book without talking about the Fishbone interview. Because to me, in some ways, that sort of was representative of what the book overall became. I mean, it dealt with, if not everything, a lot of stuff. And, you know, I was reading that part of the book right around the time of the first presidential debates. And damned it, the Fishbone interview didn't address busing, too. I mean, there was just so many things in there that I just thought were so timely and interesting. And there's also kind of it's hard not to be struck by how much fate played a pivotal role in you know, all kinds of artists' lives and careers, but certainly in Fishbone, and just catching a dead Kennedy show just because they thought it was a crazy name, and that's kind of sent them off on the punk path, where otherwise they may have gone a different direction. And
it's interesting because they weren't Angelo and Nora were really willing to take the time and effort to write something. So I just had a conversation with them and then edited it. And when we did the audio book for this, rather than us like reading what we had edited to make their chapter, we just had another conversation. And so there's some. You know, additional or unique content in the audiobook, and everyone reads their own chapters, whether it's Dave Alvin or Jane Wiedlin or Peter Case, any of the people that contributed, reads their own chapters. And so I just had another conversation with Norwood and Angelo, and had a different conversation with Henry Rollins. So it's a little basically the same subjects, but just
different pieces. Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So.
Yeah. No, it's just so cool, and again, I mean, you really get a sense in many of these pieces, but I guess just one more thing on the Fishbone thing is just little things that, but for something going slightly different, maybe there's no Fishbone, like Norwood trading his set of weights for the bass, and especially the apartment manager who not only didn't ask them to quiet down when they were like tearing apart the place, he lived, I think, right above them or below them or something, but not only that, but gave them their first kind of meaningful praise. And I think Norwood, I think somebody says they allowed us to become who we needed to be. And I thought, wow, that's super powerful.
Yes. Well, to fill in the audience, Norwood and his brother Fish were they were starting to play together when they were like 4 and 6 years old. They first got instruments. And then by this time, by the apartment manager moment, they're, you know, teenagers, and they have a full band rehearsal in an apartment like a, you know, an 8-plex or whatever. So they're just blowing up this apartment. And like you say, rather than the apartment manager saying, "You kids, damn you kids, you know, shut the hell up," he said, "You guys got a pretty good groove going this time, you know?"
Yeah.
And you know, the way that Angelo talks about living in the San Fernando Valley, which was mostly white, and then transitioning to like what inside his house was and what outside his house was, is said in such an eloquent and simple way that you can understand that he had this huge schism going on.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is happening here? Because he's experiencing racism when he goes to get on the bus and he's outside his house. And then inside his house, it's all cool. And it's, you know, it's as if he was living in a black neighborhood, but he's not. So it's like, and he admits to really hating the people that were on his case, you know?
Yeah.
Understandably so, but it was a kind of a window into what that's like, and I don't think everybody gets that.
Right.
We should get it more.
Right.
But he said it in such a direct way that it's like, oh wow, yeah.
Well, that's what I meant. It's stuck. Like but it was like there's a few different things that were sort of portals into some stuff that we don't often get access to. And or super timely if it's a busing or just ongoing racial issues. But also noting, between the schism of what was happening in this house, what was happening in the bus or otherwise in the valley. And then, on the other hand, how inclusive, for the most part, at least back then, the punk scene was.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I wish that it was more diverse.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to try to whitewash that and say, oh, it was like, you know, people of every stripe and there was no conflict.
Yeah.
Because that's just not true.
Right. I mean,
it was primarily white, but
yeah,
it did, you know, if people wanted to suffer the abuse that we suffered, like getting called names just because you had a leather jacket on or
right
hair, you know.
Yeah.
If you want to suffer that abuse and you're gay, great.
Yeah.
Come on.
Right.
You can be part of our club and, you know, feel a little bit of camaraderie and some support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the fact that he felt that conflict, the inside the apartment, outside the apartment thing, and yet felt at home and largely included when they were playing music and kind of rising.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, you know, and he talks about some of the, like the way the Busboys, which were another band, took him under their wing, and they were mostly black. I'm not sure if it was an all-black band, but they were playing more kind of new wave music, and they just thought, you know, this is fun. This is just fun.
Yeah.
And we want to jump around and just get crazy. They were all part of that ska movement that was happening early on in L.A., and I know that influenced bands like No Doubt. I mean, the Chili Peppers were there as well, but Chili Peppers got support from this whole other, group of people that were doing a similar thing.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with John Doe of X about the new book, More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of L.A. Punk. If you'd like to ask John a question, join the conversation in some way, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. And if you are joining us a little bit afterwards, I should note that we're speaking to him from the barn, from the horse barn. So there you go. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with John Doe.
Hey, Duncan.
Hey.
I just had a couple of questions for John.
Okay.
I didn't hear who the publisher of the book was.
It was by...
I can find it. I look forward to reading it. And also whether there's any talk of maybe a Knitters redo. I heard him mention Dave Albin a minute ago.
Knitters is tough because everybody's so busy, and that's just kind of our little vacation time. It's published by Hachette and DeCapo.
H-E-S-H-E-T-T-E.
Yeah, H-A-C-H-E-T-T-E.
Okay.
But the publisher, the imprint is DeCapo, DACAPO. And, you know, gotcha. Your local bookstore could order it, or you can get it on the dreaded Amazon, or, you know, any of the other
Yeah, pretty much wherever you get your books, you can find this one. It's
sounds great. Yeah. I really enjoyed seeing you guys at State Theater in 17 for your 40th reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Excellent. I think we're out there. Thanks. It's good hearing from you and what you're doing with the horses, man.
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
You bet.
So one more thing maybe on the book, and then we have other things at least some of us would like to cover. So one thing, you're overseeing the book, but periodically there's pieces in the interview with Fisherman, as we noted. And at one point, you're pretty tough on some decisions that X made, like in selecting a producer and just the general recording of Ain't Love Grand.
Yeah, it wasn't the best time, but you know, eventually you can believe your own hype, and we should have known better, but we thought we were invincible. So, you know, it's not a terrible record, it's just not the record I would have made. And you know, it felt good to be honest. It felt good to kind of talk about the way, you know, the way your personality can get messed up, and you can, you know, the way I behaved with Xene sometimes was not most admirable, and it's, you learn, live and learn, and yeah.
Yeah.
I was glad that they didn't reprint that. They did a kind of a big story in L.A. For the free paper. I'm glad they didn't reprint that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
But on the topic of new material, the last time you were on the show, I was noting how active and great X is still as a live act, and I asked if you could ever foresee there being new music. And you kind of teased me about, like, the hackneyed, any chance of new X songs question. Then, several months ago, I read that X has written the material and had it in the studio to record it. So I'm thinking, wow, okay, so what can you tell me about the new music?
I wish I had a timeline for you.
Okay.
We recorded 5 songs, one new one, one reimagined song, and three other older songs that we never did, like, proper recordings of. And Xene and I have been writing a few other songs, so hopefully by next year there'll be some, like an EP or something.
Okay.
Something.
All
I'm
right.
I'm not sure, but two of them were, one of them is called Delta 88, which we put on an anthology, but we never really did a proper recording of it.
Okay.
So we did a, you know, real recording of that. And another one was called Heater. We did an actual recording of that. And Cyrano de Bergerac's Back is another one that we did. So
nice.
I'm going to try to do something while we're talking. They're starting to feed the horses, so now they're not just happy grazing in the pasture.
Oh, my God. So
while we're on the phone, I'm gonna lead one and see if the other one follows.
Okay.
To another pasture where they're more enclosed.
All right.
So now that, you know what? Now the gator's driving away, so maybe they'll behave.
All right. Well, whatever. Again, couldn't be more fitting for the Talking Animals interview, if you ask me.
I'm talking to them by saying, not yet.
Yeah, hold tight. Give me a couple more minutes. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Austin. So what prompted the move there?
Oh, kind of finances. I mean, my gal's from here, and so we had talked about it. And where we lived in the East Bay was just cold all the time. And then we came to Austin, where we have a lot of friends, a lot of old friends and newer friends. And I realized I could buy a house. So I thought, what the hell? And I don't regret it at all. I like Austin a whole lot. The quality of life is pretty great.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody who's been here for longer is saying, "Oh, you! All these new people coming in here are messing it all up." And I have to take my lumps when they say that.
Yeah, I guess I'm one of those. But yeah, you do see those comments or pieces now and again.
You know, everything has changed. There's every city is. Got more people in it because the big cities are all filled up.
Yeah.
You know, there's no room and it's too expensive. So, you know, that's why Nashville has got a resurgence in Austin and Portland and, you know, all those kinds of places.
Yeah. And of course, you've been going to Austin, and I think, for quite some time. So you kind of knew that.
Oh, yeah. I think the first time we came here was 1980 and I always liked it. But, you know, now it's like you're just getting around, you know?
Yeah.
It takes 20 minutes to get to the airport. We don't live near the airport. That's a real advantage.
Right. That's different than the Southern California experience, for sure. And then I guess, do you have a part of a, like a bar or a restaurant or some kind of little eatery there?
Yeah, there's a bar that a friend of mine has opened a few bars, and he wanted one, a neighborhood bar, and then it turned out it was in my neighborhood. So I'd visit him while he was rebuilding it and ask him if he wanted an investor, so put a little bit of money into it, and yeah, it's like 5 blocks from my house.
Wow.
It's a little dangerous.
Yeah. You spend much time there, I'm guessing?
No. Luckily, I'm on the road quite a bit.
Yeah. I gotcha.
You know, that's the thing. You gotta figure out what's important to you.
Right.
Is living important or is lifestyle important?
Right.
Kind of make that case in the book a few times.
There's
several of us that chose lifestyle over life, and they checked out early. But
yeah,
I'm not going to do that.
So just that kind of reminds me of something I was thinking about the book, just to back
and the
up.
Name for, of the, place, the name of the place is called the Long Play Lounge.
Long Play Lounge?
Long Play Lounge, and we only play vinyl.
Nice.
So, there's no Spotify. There's no, little cable for your iTunes. And
Yeah.
If you don't like what's on the turntable, just wait 20 minutes and it'll be different.
It'll be a different side. Yeah.
No sports TV.
Okay. I think we're getting the picture. This place sounds great. Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Good place.
But what you said about people that do check out reminded me, when you and Tom said, okay, turns out we are doing another book, and let's figure out how we're doing it and who's going to contribute. When you made your request or assignments, if that's even the right word, were there two or three that came in where you thought, oh my God, I mean, even though I kind of know these people and some of them contributed last time, I'm just kind of blown away or caught off guard by what they've submitted here?
Well, in the good column, I was blown away by Dave Alvins.
Mm-hmm.
He's just such a good writer, and he really encapsulate what it's like to go from being kind of regional band to getting onto a national stage as a songwriter. It's like you're not just competing with, like, did you play some or write some good songs for your homeboys, you know, you're going to compete with Bruce Springsteen now.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
And you know, Keith Morris sent us like 10,000 words or more.
Okay.
Sort of a Netflixus, and it's like, y'all can write your own book. That's fine.
Well, apparently you have.
All you need is about, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 words.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? You know, and that was a little bit like, oh God, do you want to make this phone call or do you want me?
Who got the short straw? Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
We just switched off. We had to do it for a few different people.
I'm sure.
It's all good.
Yeah. So we're in our final couple of moments. Again, we're speaking with John Doe. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. We might be able to slide in if you have a last-minute question or comment or something for John, 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org or texting 813-433-0885. So this seemed like an immensely busy year for you, not that they all aren't pretty busy, but including spending some time in Florida, right? St. Augustine, to be precise, making a film?
I did.
Yeah.
It was
give us the lowdown on that.
Terrifying. Well, a friend of mine said a couple of years ago, I said, I'm going to do a movie and you're going to be the star. I said, Kurt, that's awesome. And thinking I would never hear of it again. And then 6 months later, he goes, I'll do that movie and it's going to be a remake of DOA, the film noir movie, and you're going to be the lead and it's going to be awesome. And I would say, hell yeah, let's do it, thinking that it would never happen.
Yeah.
And then eventually it happened, and we did it on like half a shoestring budget.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying. I'm the freaking dude. I'm the guy.
Yeah. But you've done like dozens of films of different varying size roles. So was it just that you were stepping into the lead on this or?
Yeah. And I did that a little bit on Roadside Prophets.
Yeah.
But this was a period piece. This was, having to be a tough guy. It was a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And luckily we got, a friend of mine who's a teacher at UCLA to rewrite the script, because Kurt had done a kind of a faithful rendition of the original script and then started paring it down and making it a little more, just a little better. And we still realized it needed some help. So
yeah,
luckily I think we got it. I know that we have a lot of great material, but there's a long road to go still. It'll be a couple of years.
Oh, before it's edited and out, you mean?
Have anything.
Yeah. And
I mean, it's you've got to edit it. We've got to find a composer. We've got to do all that stuff.
Yeah. So it's a ways off,
but
obviously.
It was so rewarding. I mean, everyone just was doing it for the love of it. It was, it's the reason you want to get involved in creative things, to do, to do it for the right reason.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think I read somewhere St. Augustine is not standing in for anything, the on-screen story actually takes place in St. Augustine. Is that, do I have that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And that was one of the, I think, inspirations for the project, is that it's very Gothic, as you probably know.
Yeah.
It's got this kind of dark edge like Savannah does as well. And it's just physically beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to find things that look old.
Yeah, there's plenty of them.
In 1565.
Yeah. Wow. This is old. Yeah. No, but I was really intrigued by that because I just thought, wow, that's...
I've got some high hopes, but, you know,
everybody's
I've already
have to
had
be.
most of my fun.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like we're just going to have to be kind of patient on this one from what you're saying in terms of seeing it on a screen somewhere. So, cool. Well, John, I think we have just about reached the end of our time here, and luckily the horses haven't galloped away or anything, apparently. So, and again, the new book is More Fun in the New World, The Unmaking and Legacy of L.A. Punk, and as we mentioned to one of our callers earlier, again, pretty much available wherever you get your books. You can get this one, and I guess it goes without saying, it's a really great, intriguing book with just all kinds of wonderful stories from people you know and people you don't know, but you'll want to know once you open the book. So, John, thanks again for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Duncan, what a pleasure. And everybody be good to their animals and just talk to them with your brain and your heart.
There you go. Cool. Thanks, man.
All right, buddy.
All right, talk take care. You. Thanks a lot.
Bye. Bye-bye.
In a few moments, I'll talk with Allison McCulloch, who brings a distinctive wrinkle to the film reviews she writes for the site Letterboxd, which includes vegan alerts. We'll learn more about what that means and how that works just shortly. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. There should be horse-related today, so here's the Talking Animals fave, Eddie Izzard, with a piece called Horse Whisperer on today's Talking Animals on WMNF.
Horse whisperers, very touchy-feely horse trainers. Ooh, there, boy. Ooh, how tall are you? 15 hands. Ooh. You got 15 hands? You're a Martian? A Martian horse over here. Oh, I see. 15 hands. Right. Glad we didn't measure it in feet. Everything's measured in feet except horses, which are measured in hands. What happened there? Someone should be... I'm 9 bottoms tall, you know? Really? Are you? Yes. See that building? That's 29 bottoms high. He's 3 thighs tall. 4 kneecaps and a budgie gap. Where are horses measured in hands? What the... Anyway, the horse whisperer's obviously... Oh, let's see. Lie. What did you get to horse is going, I can't quite hear what you're saying, actually. I tell you what I said was, why don't you... No, I still can't quite pick it up. Just seems to be going... Horse shouters should get a lot further, shouldn't they? Walk forwards, you, walk forwards. Walk, or I hit you with this. Child.
That was Eddie Izzard with a piece called Horse Whisperer, taken from his album Live from Wembley. Now let's speak to Allison McCulloch and hear about her distinctive film reviews in Letterboxd. This is Allison McCulloch on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
For sure. First, to give credit where credit is due, I learned about you from a profile a few days ago in Tenderly. So that was cool. And so give us the nickel tour of your background as an avid film goer and critic.
All right. Well, in 2012, I completed my master's program. I was writing about women directors in silent cinema. And there were amazingly over 100 of them, and just I've been a lifelong film goer, but in 2017 I became vegan.
And then?
So about 2 months later I saw this film called Amnesia, directed by Barbet Schroeder, and there's this scene where he catches a fish, scales it, guts it, and it was just too much. It was the first time I had like a really strong reaction. Actually, you know, there has been lots of animal abuse featured in films, and you know, sometimes you just turn a blind eye, or before I'd be like, okay, this is just what it's like in slaughterhouses. But that was the first time as a vegan where I just became more conscious of it.
So where did the inspiration, I guess, to have those kind of reactions and say, hey, I'm going to note these things by way of, like, not just in the course of my reviews, but actually bust them out with sort of with vegan alerts. How did you come up with that idea? And how did you say, you know what, that's, yeah, I like that idea. I'm going to go ahead with it.
Right. It just sort of evolved. Also in 2017, MoviePass happened, and I wanted to track my daily record of going to the movies using MoviePass. And so I was going to the movies every day, and it just sort of evolved. I just noted when there was animal abuse or people even eating non-vegan food, supporting the industry.
And so how has that worked? I mean, what kind of reaction have you gotten from people that log in and read your reviews?
Oh, it's all across the board. Some people love it, some people appreciate it, and some people are just, it blows their mind. They don't even grasp. They think it's a joke.
So give us a little sampling, if you could, from each of those categories. So, like, a comment or two, I guess, that from people who really like what you do, who others maybe who can't quite figure out what's going on, and then the people that are clearly in the troll or don't like it category.
Right. Well, I try to ignore the trolls. At first, it was hurtful or whatever, but I was reading Twitter the other day, and someone wrote, you know, oh, I was watching this movie, and I think the vegan movie review girl on Letterboxd would hate it. And I have no idea what the movie was, but I think it's funny that people are thinking about the vegan alert. Just warning them if there is animal cruelty.
So can you, I'm sure there, you don't want to necessarily give these people too much credence, but can you think of somebody that has written in, like, that was, like, upset with what you do, or just couldn't understand why those alerts were...
Oh, sure. I mean, this isn't the Tenderly article, but, you know, Avengers Endgame, I guess there's an emotional scene involving a hamburger, and, you know, I was saying, you know, so he saves the world or whatever, he shouldn't, you know, kill a cow for his pleasure. And so I got really strong reactions from that. And, you know, people are like, he saved the universe. He can do whatever he wants, you know. But it just, it goes to show the varying opinions on whether or not it's okay to eat meat.
Yeah. So some people probably are familiar, maybe some people are not familiar with Letterboxd. So can you tell us about where people can read your reviews? And if there's more than one place, maybe you mentioned that as well?
Sure. I mean, it's letterboxd.com, and I am on the site as Allison M.
Okay.
You can find me. It's Allison C. M., the username.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, you can find me on there. You can go to Facebook and look for vegan movie reviews. That might be a little bit easier.
Yeah.
And also on Twitter, Instagram.
All the usual sites.
Yes, exactly.
So you mentioned in part of this discussion there about when MoviePass came along, trying to track your records. So I get the impression from that piece and just generally our conversation here that avid film goer doesn't begin to address it.
Oh, right. I'm at the movies every day. On the weekends, I'm binging. It's just, there's a never-ending supply of film.
So how many, let's say on a weekend day, what would be like a regular, quote-unquote, normal amount of films that you would see on that kind of day?
Right. Well, I used to binge, like in my 20s, I'd watch like 7 films on Saturday, 7 films on Sunday. Now it's a little bit more reasonable. I like 4 a day is binging for me.
I see. Wow. Really scaled back. And then you're a filmmaker, right, as well?
Yes, I've done some short films. I'm focusing more on film history right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just there are a lot of filmmakers in L.A., and I try to lend my talents as a sound girl and, you know, just whatever I can do to help.
Yeah. And so where, if you look a little bit down the road, do you see a book? Do you see making a feature-length film? Where do you see kind of your sort of at least twin, if not more than twin, interests going next?
Right. Well, when I first became vegan, I thought about making a documentary, and I still might down the road. I just have to find the right angle. And also, I've been doing a lot of cooking and discovering and experimenting with being raw vegan. It's been really tough, so I'm just you know, looking into different aspects, and like being vegan for me has come first now. So I put a lot of the filmmaking and film watching to the side as I try to be the healthiest person I can be.
Cool. All right. Well, we will track you and track your reviews. And again, it's just a very cool, intriguing approach to film reviews. And I was really struck by it. So it's just delightful to speak with you. So this has been Allison McCulloch. And again, you can find her on Letterboxd or just on Facebook at Vegan Film Reviews, right?
Yeah, Vegan Movie Reviews.
Vegan Movie Reviews. Sorry, I think I saw it one place at Vegan Film Reviews. But yeah, Vegan Movie Reviews. Okay, cool. Yeah, well, thanks for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Brecken.
Okay, bye-bye. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lurie with Radioactivity, extending this three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lele. Then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with the wonderful new show, Euro Radio, hosted by Paco Morales. And that, of course, eases right into Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music at 2 p.m. and continuing with all kinds of wonderful music after that. Meanwhile, on today's show, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a copy of the new book we just discussed with John Doe. So it's time for, indeed, Name That Animal Tune. It's a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WMNF in the last 90 days. And we'll give a copy of the new book to the first person who calls in 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
There's a black horse in a photograph. His mane blows in your face. There's a black horse in a photograph. His mane blows in your face. Your eyes are hidden. Will you be taken?
We have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Instagram page, Twitter feed, and more. Please like us and or follow us on all those things. And you can also subscribe there to our weekly newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other scintillating news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. And along those lines, if you'd seen this week's newsletter, you'd see a humble brag about a new piece I did for the Washington Post all about sidecar dogs. It's mostly photo feature, which is the right thing. Very little writing, mostly photos. But anyway, so if you search Washington Post sidecar dogs, you'll see that. And it's some pretty cool photos, including a sidecar dog and his rider from Tampa, Richard Nordstrom and Harley. So anyway, meanwhile, have a good week. Be kind to your others. Be kind to yourself. And of course, be kind to animals, just as John was trying to read there out in the pasture. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Thanks so much for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. NPR News headlines coming up presently, and then Rob Lurie and Radioactivity after that. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next Wednesday on Talking Animals.